Dean Vic Amar from the University of Illinois. Did you know that one, Dean?
No, I wouldn't have even taken a guess. Although when he said speeding, you should have given that to him because speeding is a generic.
I know.
It doesn't have to be a car.
I gave it to him eventually.
You made him work for it.
I want exactly this. You know, this is a legal show, right? We ask for specifics, and in the courtroom, we want and just like here on the air, we want to make sure that we get all the answers. Dean Amar, thanks for hopping on with us today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, indeed.
And apologies in advance if we have to break in to talk a little weather. We've been talking about the shadow docket. I feel like we've heard more about the shadow docket from the Supreme Court over the past year or so than maybe anyone's ever talked about it combined the previous 200-some years of our nation's history. What is the shadow docket?
So it's a term used to describe cases that come to the Supreme Court and are resolved by the Supreme Court without the ordinary full-blown process where the court grants review in a case and then the parties spend months submitting briefs and then reply briefs and then the justices prepare for half an hour or an hour or more's worth of oral arguments. And then the justices deliberate after that, and it takes them months and months to generate an opinion. This is a much more telescoped, truncated a path to get the Supreme Court to rule on one's case. So typically, the shadow docket cases involve time of the essence, emergency kind of matters.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not quite true that it's only been in the last year or so. I would say it's more like the last 3 or 4 years.
Oh, okay.
And it was kind of, you know, maybe a somewhat gradual increase. But I think what's unnerving to some people is that the Supreme Court seems to be using these emergency petitions to resolve really important, complicated questions of federal law without the benefit of full-blown briefing and, in particular, from my point of view, amicus briefing. Those are briefs filed by so-called amicus curiae, friends of the court. So law professors, industry individuals who have special expertise on the questions that the court is taking up. In the ordinary course of things, there are months and months for these outsiders who aren't parties to the case, but who care about the Supreme Court getting it right. They can submit briefs that provide expertise to the court. Because one of the things that most people don't realize is the Supreme Court is essentially a group of generalists.
Mm-hmm.
Members of the Supreme Court aren't particularly expert in tax law or constitutional law, even. None of the Supreme Court justices know much about constitutional law compared to the top constitutional law professors. We saw this in Judge Jackson's hearing. Judge Jackson is a very fine lower court judge, but she didn't have kind of the depth and ready command that professors in various fields that she was asked about might, because as a judge, she has to be a generalist. She has to hear different kinds of cases, so she's not going to be as deep in any one area of law. That's why the court, traditionally, and the Supreme Court in particular, have been receptive to amicus briefs from experts in various fields, but you don't have time to do any of that when you decide cases in the span of a few weeks and issue rulings that might not have quite as much precedential effect, because the court itself recognizes that rulings issued without a lot of process aren't entitled to as much precedential weight.
Right.
But they still are entitled to a fair bit because they resolve the case, they send messages. And once the court issues a decision, even a time-constrained one in a shadow docket case, that creates the status quo against which all other decisions are going to be had. So the court doesn't like to reverse itself and change course, even when the earlier ruling happened to be one that wasn't the product of a full-blown process.
Right. Dean, we're going to take a break. I want after the break to like put some examples to like what used to be considered par for the course for what the shadow docket would do, and maybe an example of what they've done recently that has caused controversy. Does that sound good after the break?
Sure.
I think that'll help everyone understand it a little bit more. All right, quick break here on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association on WGN. 720 WGN, John Hansen here, and this is Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. We'll continue our conversation with Dean Vic Amara of the University of Illinois in a moment. Just want to update people on what we're seeing in the weather world, and this is a pretty strong line of storms all the way down to Champaign. Well, you know what? I'm not going to use severe weather as a transition to the University of Illinois Dean. I guess I just did that, sir. Vic Amar continues our conversation about the shadow docket, and we were talking about its use over the last 3 or 4 years in situations where maybe it hadn't really been used. So, Dean, can we just try and like get an example of what used to be used in a shadow docket case versus what we've seen the last couple of years?
Sure. I think, 30 years ago, for example, a high percentage of the emergency applications to the Supreme Court were some parties asking the Supreme Court to intervene very quickly to preserve the status quo, tended to involve things like imminent capital executions.
Okay.
So a state is going to put someone to death at 12:01 a.m., and the lawyer for the defendant goes to the Supreme Court the day before and asks five justices to issue a stay of execution for the convicted person because they have some legal claim that they feel that hasn't been fully and fairly vetted yet. And of course, if the individual is put to death, then that's irreversible. So they're asking the court to kind of hold the status quo at that time. Sometimes the court did, most of the time it did not. But preserving the status quo in those cases tended not to resolve the merits of a case so much as just buy time. Mm. Now, I'm not saying that a state doesn't have an interest in following a particular timeline for its executions. You heard the phrase, justice delayed is justice denied. So there's certainly something to be said for moving the wheels of justice forward. But I think it wasn't as controversial as some of the more recent settings. I'll give you a few examples. During COVID, California had a law that prevented people from getting together in homes, home get-togethers inside your house, if people from more than three households were gathering. Hmm. So you could get together with three friends from three different households, but they didn't want people from 10 households coming together on the theory that each person who represents a household is really bringing all the germs of all the people in each of those households.
And this was a law, not a guidance. This is the law.
Yeah, this was a regulation. This was a law. Religious groups argued that since people from more than three households can get together when they go to a grocery store like Myers or when they go to a hair salon or something, that it was discrimination against religion to deny people the right to have religious get-togethers that involved persons from more than three households. Now, I think that the immediate rejoinder is, well, no, it's not, because grocery stores are very different than home get-togethers. In a grocery store, you don't sit next to someone for 45 minutes without moving around. We all know how it was at the peak of COVID. We would go into the grocery store and keep our head down and get our goods and get through the checkout as quickly as possible. Importantly, this law didn't discriminate against religion vis-a-vis, say, other home get-togethers. So if you had a birthday party or an anniversary party or a political get-together, all of those were subject to the same three-household limit that religious get-togethers were. So I think there was a good argument, the one Justice Kagan made in dissent, that this didn't constitute discrimination against religion. And yet five justices, without briefing, essentially decided that this kind of setup constitutes a violation of the Free Exercise Clause, and California can't do it. Now, that's making major new law in a dubious way, to my mind, in a setting where they didn't even really get all of the analysis and arguments that they should have. Another example, just last month, after North Carolina drew congressional district lines, because after every 10-year census, legislatures draw new district lines. So they drew congressional district lines, and the disappointed Republicans went to the Supreme Court and said what the state legislature did So the state legislature drew its district lines, but the North Carolina Supreme Court invalidated those district lines on the ground that they were impermissibly partisan. Mm-hmm. So they said the North Carolina Constitution regulates excessive partisan gerrymandering. So they basically invalidated those lines and ordered and facilitated new ones to be drawn. And disappointed Republicans who had controlled the process in the North Carolina legislature went to the U.S. Supreme Court and said, you've got to undo what the North Carolina Supreme Court did so we get to have the district lines that we want to going into the spring season. Now, again, either way you go, you're going to disappoint somebody. But when you make – if three justices wanted to grant that application and undo what the North Carolina Supreme Court did, which would have been making new law on the merits, and again, to my mind, quite dubious law, happily, a majority of justices declined that, but it was on the verge of making a big new decision in the context of this telescoped decision making.
Right. So,
just a case this past week involved affirmative action, the same kind of thing.
Yeah. So, what you're saying is the shadow docket ruling carries the same weight, especially if it creates new interpretations of the law, as one does with.
It doesn't carry quite the same weight because the Supreme Court has said that its past rulings, which are entitled to a lot of respect by the U.S. Supreme Court and by lower federal courts, are not entitled to quite the same respect if they are issued on a kind of a rapid timeline. So the Supreme Court itself does not treat its shadow docket rulings with quite the same weight that it does regular rulings, but lower courts have to treat it with respect.
Right, because there's no
lower
other...
Lower federal courts have to take it as binding because they're bound by that. And even though the U.S. Supreme Court can say we don't really give that much weight to our past shadow docket rulings, as people, the justices always like to be consistent with what they've done in the past.
Right.
If they voted to grant review, if they voted to grant relief in a shadow docket case, they don't want to admit they made a mistake a year later when the case, the same issue comes back in a full, more fully briefed case.
Yeah.
So the reality is, it's human nature to continue what you've been doing, and that's why these rulings have significant effect.
Dean, we are out of time, Dean Amar. I just want to ask, but if five justices say they want to rake this ruling, that's how it goes, right? There's the chief justice can't step in and say, nah, we're not going to do that. Five justices, that's all you need, right?
Once you get to five, that's all you need.
All right. Dean Vic Amar, thanks for breaking this down for us. I appreciate it.
Take care.
All right.
Be safe.